we unite East and West Coast to present the package. So the country is together. And what a special day. For years, we have been planning and promising to keep, to bring Daniel Assisi to Baltimore. But, you know, life is so complicated. Daniel is not complicated. He's very busy. He's very, very busy. He says he's complicated. That's another story. But he is a good friend of ours. We have known him for quite a number of years. And in the Spiritist family, he is of a third generation Spiritist family. His grandfather, Armando Assisi, was one of the presidents of the Brazilian Spiritist Federation. All right? So the family is very much into practicing Spiritism, sharing it with everybody else. And they shared so much, they sent Daniel out of Brazil. You can go there and multiply the talent. So that's why he's here. And we're very blessed that he's here with us. And of course, professionally, he is in charge of pretty much like a manager of charter schools. You can imagine how busy he can be in a daily basis. And there he also is one of the directors of the Blossom Spiritist Society, director and founder, together with Akemi Adams. And he's in charge of the English-speaking meetings in their center and has been helping with translations in many ways, giving talks everywhere and elsewhere in the United States and abroad, and has been also a collaborator of the Spiritist magazine. And it's with great joy that you're going to join us in welcoming very warmly our friend Daniel Assisi.
How's everyone doing? Good? Great. Well, it's really, really a great pleasure to be here with you today. I want to say place, but it's really not a place, right? Because the place doesn't matter. The Spirit Society of Baltimore is really dear to my heart. For years, we've been following what you guys have been doing, talking every so often too with Danielle and Vanessa, and I've known these guys for quite a bit of years too. It's always great to be somewhere else, very far away from where you live or call home, but nevertheless, be able to feel completely at home and partake in the joy that is to be with people that think the same way you do, that want to evolve, to want to go forward the same way you do. And that really kind of straightens our bonds of friendship, but also reminds us that this is a beautiful thing that we're doing, to try to come together, whatever it is, our beliefs, our inclinations, our perceptions, to try to find meaning for life and grow together. And this topic is extremely, extremely interesting because how often do we get to talk about this, right? We see that every day in our lives, and that's one great thing about Spiritism, that's very practical. We can get all this information and all this theory that we learn, and we can apply to our day-to-day lives right now. And as we clearly know, our nation is faced in very difficult economical times, and having the opportunity to brainstorm a little bit about that, it's great. It kind of gives us direction. So, but before I start, though, I got to say that it's really great to kind of be the last one to speak. Because when you got like nice, caring, smart people that speak before you, they do all the heavy lifting, right? So I just have to go over here, crack some jokes, be nice, and then hopefully everything's going to be okay because everybody said what really was important. But what I do want to talk to you a little bit is about Christ consciousness, solutions for the crisis, because I think that Spiritism has this very practic approach to things. It really helps us put the foot, the pedal to the metal to find practical solutions for this whole crisis. Before we start talking about Christ consciousness, and I want to do that in a very different way, I was pretty sure they're going to cover everything that was really important. So I'm going to take a little bit of a detour, if you don't mind. I want to do a little bit of a Zen approach, talk about Christ indirectly, about Christ consciousness, if that's okay, because I think the Spiritism is a beautiful, progressive body of knowledge that allows us to really look at the world differently. So before we talk about a stimulus package, we have to understand why it's the stimulus package for, right? It's a crisis. So what is a crisis, I was thinking. So because I have to rely on people that are smarter than me, I went to the dictionary and I kind of looked it up. And the crisis is defined in the, you know, dictionary.com, which is based on Random House Dictionary. It's a stage in a sequence of events at which the trend of all future events, especially for better or for worse, is determined. It's a turning point. A condition of instability or danger, as in social, economic, political, or international affairs, leading to a decisive change and a dramatic emotional or circumstantial upheaval in a person's life. And I think we can agree that's our days. That's our day-to-day life. This is our times, right? And to illustrate that, I found that a little bit of art could help us. We have Edvard Munch, The Scream. I think we all know that famous picture that conveys a lot of the desperation about the loneliness and somewhat of the dense darkness of it all. So I wanted to revisit first the concept of crisis so that we can kind of come together as a common denominator on what is it that we're trying to address, right? And here's when I start taking a little bit of a meandering path and I ask for your indulgence. And hopefully I'll come together at the end somehow. If not, please feel free to throw some tomatoes or something. Okay, so I wanted to talk about a different kind of crisis by illustrating, I don't know if you guys are familiar, with the Allegory of the Cave by Plato, the Greek philosopher, disciple of Socrates. And an allegory is nothing more but a symbol that's been stretched over and over. That is, it's a symbol that you can keep reusing. So it's a symbol within a symbol. It's a story that has many symbols that come together. And Plato's Allegory of the Cave, it's really, truly a fantastic thing. And here's why. Plato, talking to his disciples, of which one of them was Aristotle, illustrated life being like an allegory of the cave, in which, get this, look how interesting this is. There are prisoners that have been born and raised in shackles in a dark cave, and they are perpetually facing the wall of the cave. And they've known nothing else but the walls of the cave. And behind them, at the back, we have a fire that keeps going on. And that fire, with the light, comes this way and reflects the shades, the shadows of things behind them, right? And there are other people that move, creatures that go by and forth and move things. And then this prisoner's over here, shackled, which know nothing of this, think that the shadows are actually the reality. So for them, their life is the shadows are cast on this wall, but they don't even know that's a shadow. So that's all they know. And they grow up like this, and that's all there is to it. But what if one of these prisoners, for some reason, was to break away from these shackles and turn around and find out there's something else going on? And he decides to go out and investigate for himself. So he goes up the path, sees the fire, sees everything else, and finds an exit to the cave. And knowing this is a bright new world, he rushes out. And what happens to him? He's blinded to begin with. Because he's been in a cave for so long that there's so much light that he doesn't know what it is. So he kind of has to walk back a little bit. There's a moment of confusion. He lets his eyes adjust. And then he understands and goes out and sees a brand new world. And he goes, wow, I could never have imagined that there was so much more to it other than just the shadows in the cave. So what does he decide to do, according to Plato? Taken by this moment of joy and understanding the implications of being outside the cave, he decides, I can't just be here by myself. There are people still in the cave. I have to go back and let them know that there is a brave new world out here. So what does he do? He takes the path back and tries to free his friends, the prisoners, they're still in shackle, to let them know that there is a world out there and that this is nothing but shadows of a fire that's not even the true light that's outside. And what do? Do they jump for joy and immediately say, let's go? No, they shoot it down. They say, no, that is nonsense. That's all we ever known. That's what we know. That's how things are. We are fine with it. And in great sadness, he leaves and follows his path. So the reason I want to talk a little bit about the allegory of the cave is it's yet another example of a crisis, a personal crisis, a crisis in which we realize that there is a different dimension to the world that we live in. When we realize there's a different way of looking at things. Were it not for this crisis, for this moment of doubt and pain, our friend who was able to unshackle himself and move out would never know the beauty of the outside world. Right? So when we talk about a crisis, we are naturally have to loop back to our financial crisis. We've been bombarded with the idea of financial crisis for a couple of years now. We all heard the stories about foreclosures and banks crashing and everything else. And we always ask ourselves, was this warranted? Did we do something wrong? Did we create this? What happened? What was going to happen next? And we end up engaging in a lot of self-destructive thought, a lot of damaging attitudes, right? We've heard about the foreclosures, the subprime crash, which basically was we were lending money to people who could not afford it, to have those loans repaid properly. Because they wanted to have those things. They wanted to have the material things that other people did. They wanted to have more. They wanted to have their neighbor had it. They wanted it. They wanted a Rolls Royce. They wanted a car. They wanted a bigger home. And because of that, the whole system collapsed when we understood that we could not just borrow and not pay back. As a consequence, banks lost a lot of money because all of a sudden they couldn't be repaid. So they decided to cut back. What did they cut? They cut jobs. And then we go into a frenzy, right? We're losing jobs. So people then thinking there is a crisis in the horizon, what do? They start preparing themselves. They start cutting themselves before they have to because they know it's coming. So therefore, they take a proactive stance so that they don't lose their wealth, their physical wealth, and cut straight away. And when you cut straight away, what happens? Those people are let go, and a snowball effect takes place. So whether there is a crisis or not, there is also a self-fulfilling prophecy to it. The moment that we believe things are going down the drain, we start to fend for ourselves. We start cutting loose of all the ties that we have. We freak out, for lack of a better word, and we all go down together. It's kind of like rearranging the chairs on the Titanic. There is no point, right? The Titanic's going down, but we're still rearranging the chairs on the Titanic. So, Mike, obviously this is a traumatic experience. I mean, we see here an example. This is, you know, the exchange markets and everything else crashing, and we're seeing those numbers flashing and people being extremely desperate about it, panic everywhere. And obviously, I don't want to downplay the crisis. I'm saying it's obviously a tough, really tough thing because people lose their jobs, their livelihoods, and that has a snowball effect. So it's a really terrible thing. But the fundamental question that we should be asking ourselves is, are we worse morally, individually, because there is a crisis? The fact that we have less wealth, does it make us less of a better person? That's one thing that we keep forgetting and that we talked about briefly here, which was because we don't have the material wealth, does it mean that we are not good people? Does it mean that we can't carry on? What do? Right? And that's when we go into the physical experience that Leo and Carol and Vanessa talked about as well. We oftentimes confuse the physical experience with being the ultimate thing. We confuse the means with the end. To talk about money, which is always a really tough topic, right? And I think it was covered so very well that money is not the root of all evil, right? The love of money is the root of all evil. We always misquote that, actually. We always say money is the root of all evil, but it's actually the original thing in the Bible is the love of money, the attachment to physical things. So what I wanted to do was I started thinking, what is money, right? So I imagine, I have a vivid imagination. I went back to my, you know, my mind, and I start thinking, when did money come about? And what was there before money? And obviously, the first thing I imagine are two cavemen walking around, ooga booga style, right? Caveman number one, let's call him Joe. And then caveman number two, let's call him John. Joe goes to John, you know, looks at his fur and points and goes, ooga booga. John looks at his fur and says, ooga booga. Joe goes back, ooga booga. John turns around to and see his clave and says, ooga booga. So now we have Joe and John. Each one has something that the other wants. So they swap their fur for their clave. And there it goes. First financial transaction ever recorded in humanity. Right? So that makes complete sense. That when you have something that somebody else wants and they have something that you want, it's easy. You just swap it. You just barter it, right? You exchange one for the other. But let's put more people into it. Let's say there is a cave woman. And I, as the caveman, want to impress said cave woman. And therefore, I want to get that, you know, that fur that was purchased before to buy an offer to her instead of hitting her over the head with a clave. Because we know that's not the proper way of doing things. We've learned. We've developed. We get there, and then I go out to the other caveman and ask him to exchange that fur something else for another clave. And he doesn't want to. He wants something another caveman has. But I don't have anything that that caveman has that I could give him to get that and then exchange here. So it gets to be a very complicated system really quickly, right? So what do we come up with as a, you know, humanity? Precious metals. Everybody likes the shiny things. Ooh, it's shiny, right? So we find these metals that are not so, you know, common, and we start using those instead. I say, well, you know, I'm going to give you so much of this little metal, because everybody wants those metals. It's something common. So it's easy for you to get the metal in exchange for something else. So it gets a little bit more abstract. Can you see that? So we start carrying around gold and precious metals. And then we decide that's really too complicated and they're kind of heavy. So we decide, you know what? Let's create currency. And by the way, currency was first with the heavy metals. So you have those gold coins and everything else. They were worth exactly their weight. Which actually is a funny story, by the way. The funny, really smart guys, I don't know if you know this, but in Rome, some of the, you know, the coins, do you ever know why there's a little, you know, some slits on your coins around? Because those first smart guys, knowing that it was worth the weight, what they started to do was they started to shave those coins. So they have a little, they can still use for the value, but still have those shavings that which they, can they make another coin. So they start making those little slits so that you know that if the coin didn't have the slits, it wasn't worth its own. Anyways, see, there's always some cheating going on. Because that's the level where we are still. So we got into currency, we got into paper. And now the paper is supposed to symbolize what? The amount of precious metal that you have. Instead of carrying that around, you have a wad of paper. And you take those things and you pay. So that makes complete sense, right? So it's just making things easier for us. And then comes the banks and they say, why are you carrying paper around? Let me give you this piece of plastic, right? That can carry this for you, and that way you don't have to carry those things. And then it gets really abstract all of a sudden. Before it was objects, and then it was precious metals, and then it was paper, and now it's just numbers. You know? If you ask, like, where's my money? And you go to the bank, you're likely not to find it. It's just an abstract thing. We get paid in numbers. It's a direct deposit, right? It goes into account. We maybe touch it, you know. I don't carry cash anymore because if I do, I spend. So that's rule number one. Don't carry cash with you, you spend. I run the card, and then it's just kind of a really interesting process, right? We spiritualized the process, right? We went from the physical to the abstract. It's funny how the physical world works that way too, right? So, and now people are literally pulling out their heads, which is really sad because I have none left, because numbers went up or down. So once you take a step back, we start thinking, wow, why are we living our lives based on numbers? Another way to illustrate that makes a lot of sense to me is to find out, you know, possessions and versus like moral values. What I owe is not who I am, but sometimes we see it so much that we swap it a little bit around, right? My first car, if you mind, I'll tell you a little story. It was called Gigi. Gigi was two G's for the grocery getter, because it was a beaten-up Toyota station wagon that I bought for $3,000. Best car ever. I figured if I mocked Gigi before anybody else did, because I was in college, it would be okay. So I made a license plate, Gigi the grocery getter. Everybody loved Gigi, right? So I decided, I went to work and got a little bit more money, and I decided that I was going to buy a better car. And when I went to work, I did buy a very nice car, very expensive car. But guess what happened? I'm like, ooh, I got to watch out now. What if I scratch my car? What kind of insurance? Maybe I shouldn't drive because it's going to devalue. The more miles I put, the less it's worth. Should I buy a second car? Funny, huh? But seriously, I went down, I'm not kidding, I went down this road in my mind, maybe I should buy a cheaper car and drive it around. And then I caught myself and saying, okay, who's got what now? Do I own the car or does the car own me? Right? And then it was an important moment for me because I realized that who owns who? What's the point of me working to get a physical thing if later on I won't use it, I'll be worried about the physical thing? What have I done? What did I do it for? Right? So in this crisis, it reminds me a little bit of this. Sometimes we lose touch with what's really important, what we talked about the experience, the family, the use of things. And we focus on what's visible, right? Because what's visible is still easier for us to understand. Even though we're beginning to understand and realize that there's more than just meets the eye, right? I don't know if you ever guys ever read a lovely little book called The Little Prince. It's a marvelous little book. It's fantastic. It's really worth reading slowly because it's a really deep book. Sounds very simple. It's like 20 pages long. I don't know. But he, the little prince there, in his conversation with the grown-up, by the way, grown-ups never get anything. That's what the little prince says. He says, you know, what's essential, it's invisible to the eye. And that's a beautiful quote, right? What's essential is invisible to the eye. Sure, we can have a better car. We can have a better house. And that's okay. We are allowed to have that. But are we slaves to it? Is the car driving us, or are we driving the car? Is the home defining who I am, or am I spending my whole entire existence to pay for that home that I'm not enjoying because I can't stay in it because I have to go to work to pay for it? It's a curious thing. And we are always reminded, of course, of the Christ that says, for where your heart is, there is also your treasure. And that's a very interesting thing, how thousands of years later from Ooga Booga land, right, we find ourselves trapped by the very thing that we created to help us in the process. Whereas money or wealth or physical things are meant to help us in the process so that we can achieve that way we should want, which are moral values, sometimes we walk off a little bit of the track. And that's okay, because it will happen. But then there are moments and beautiful events in our lives that reminds us of the important things, that makes us stop and think about things. This financial crisis is one of them. Is it painful? Absolutely. Will it go away tomorrow? No, it will not. Will it change our lives? Yes, and we hope so. Because it's forcing us, literally, to reconsider how we do things. And that's very interesting because I've read a lot of, I'm reading it, you know, I listen a lot on the car. I live in Los Angeles, so I do commute quite a bit, like 40 minutes a day, which is quite a bit for me because I'm really lazy. And I listen to NPR and National Public Radio, and there's a lot of reports coming out that a lot of families are cutting back on entertainment expenses, right? Because that's the first thing that you should cut when you're cutting back and you're having a tough time. They're no longer going to the movies. They're no longer, you know, playing video games because they're expensive. And what are they doing instead? They're talking. They're talking to each other. They're playing board games. Now, have you guys heard about the concept of staycation? Yes, right? Because there's vacation and there's staycation. A staycation is when you have a vacation, but you don't go anywhere. You stay at home. And which is a great idea because you actually enjoy what you have. And if you really think about it, you don't need to go somewhere else to enjoy it. So it's quite fantastic. So it's interesting how we have an opportunity to redirect our thoughts, to redirect to us all to what's really important. Is it a tough lesson? No doubt. No doubt. But we should learn to make the best of it. Because if we truly are open to the process, everything that happens, like Carl said here before, If God's just and caring, clearly He loves us so much that He's always going to give us ways to develop ourselves. So there's always a silver lining to things. There's always something very powerful that will let us reconnect. Even if the crisis was not our own cause, you know, even if it didn't cause it, we're not directly involved with it, we still benefit from it in the sense that we should stop and think about what is it that it's going out in the outside world and how that affects my inside world, right? And that's the biggest tip, I guess, I can really give you, if any. I was thinking, what kind of practical solutions for the Christ could I come with an enlightened thing, some beautiful saying that will you make you go like, wow, and I just really want to do that to help people change their lives, and I realize I can't do that. So I have to rely on smarter people like Plato, like the folks that went before us and talked a little bit about this stuff. And it kept coming to my mind, what can we do in a practical world? And this crossroads that we find ourselves in. Stop, look, and listen. Stop, as in stop rushing through the process and just stop, right? There's a beautiful passage actually in the Old Testament that says, be still and know that I am God, right? Because if we are just running around and there's no point, there's time for reflection. So let's stop. Let's stop things the way you're doing. Doesn't mean we got to stop everything. Let's cool down. Let's take a breather. Let's look around. Let's look outside our world, physical world and our internal world, and ask ourselves, what is it that I want? And let's listen. Let's listen to what divinity, God, consciousness, whatever it is that you want to call it, a higher divine power is telling us. And what are we telling ourselves? Because we never listen to what we really want to do. We just go. Keep going. Let's meditate. You're agonizing over something, maybe we can pray. Let's try to reflect. And what can that really give us? I figured, well, one way of looking at the world and going outside ourselves to think about things that are sometimes outside of our regular passage, I mean, a mode, at least for me, is I figured the best way to really talk about Christ consciousness in very practical things about detaching oneself from matter would to quote the Buddha. Because all these beautiful divine processes and thoughts, they're all related. We all work for the same boss. I don't see why we still keep arguing about it. It's the same boss, right? We all report to the same guy. So there are a lot of things, and there's nothing more Christ consciousness than the teachings, for instance, of Buddha. And the first there is something called Four Noble Truths, which he arrived after a lot of meditation. He went out, he was a rich prince, the mythology goes, walked into the world, saw a lot of misery, had different signs, realized that his palace, his shelter life was not it. So he decided to go out and see the world for himself and change. So he meditated and came up with Four Noble Truths. And this is a beautiful psychological treaty, by the way, treatise, because it clearly foreshadows psychology in the ways that would come thousands of years, well, about 2,000 years later, but also points us in a very introspective direction, which is very interesting. And he said that there's the first noble truth is life is a trial. We often going to find that translated as life is suffering. But what really the original meaning is life is tribulation. We go through troubles, through problems. But clearly, I think we can agree that life is not about suffering. Right? Life is about thriving. It's dealing with suffering. Suffering, I want to say, it's a choice. Pain might not be a choice. Suffering, however, is. So the first noble truth is that we need to find that life is a trial. The second noble truth that he came up with is the origin of suffering is attachment. We suffer because we want things. If we don't want things, we don't suffer. Had I kept Gigi, the grocery getter, right, and not bought the latest and greatest, you know, car that I could at the time, I would not have suffered the process of attachment. Sounds so simplistic, it's kind of annoying. right? It's kind of like, feel like slapping Buddha in the head if I could, because it's so obvious that makes me feel so like, oh, how, you know, how didn't I see that before? But then the great truths are very simple, are right there for us, right? And the third noble truth, this is a beautiful process, because, I mean, it seems like we can just stop right here and be done with it, right? But the third noble truth is very Christ-like, in that assures us that the ceasing of suffering is possible, that there will be an end to suffering, right? There's nothing more Christic in that sense than that. As we evolve and we detach ourselves from wanting things that we don't need, we will no longer suffer, right? And because he was very pragmatical and practice and practical, he gives us a way that the way to avoid suffering, right, to deal with this and arrive this, is the Eightfold Path, which I'm going to share with you just a little bit, which is very interesting. But I look here and I say, wow, this is fantastic, because this whole process matches completely with Christ consciousness, right? You know, happiness is not of this world, right? Those that want to follow me, pick up your own cross and follow me. Nobody else can do it for you. You can't pay somebody. Although I really do like the happiness stand, the $10 happiness stand. Wish we had one of those. We can't. We got to do it for ourselves. Like credit cards, personal and not transferable. You got to do it yourself. And there is a specific way. Clearly, the Eightfold Path is not the only way, as we know very well. There are many different ways of arriving at the same spot. This is one way he suggested. Like many other great minds and you know, spirits suggested different ways. The way in which we get there, it's important if he helps us. But it's important for us to enlarge our consciousness to understand that it's not just one single way. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be different. We wouldn't have different shades of skin, be born in different places, have different learning opportunities, different wealth levels, born in certain families and not in others, physical disabilities. We get that. We know that. That everybody is the same in that we're all unique, different. But we have different characteristics. So the Eightfold Path that that Siddhartha, Buddha, shares with us is to start with the right view, to look at the world with the right way, openness, and with the right intention to focus towards what is it that we want to do. And that hopefully will build us wisdom, because we will know what is it that we want to do. And that's already really tough, because oftentimes I find myself asking, what do I really want for life? And I'm not quite sure I got it all figured out. The third step is the right speech. Is if we know what we're thinking, then we got to communicate that properly and act properly and live a life that matches that. That is, right, to put our actions where our thoughts and our mouth is. That hopefully develops an ethical conduct. And the sixth step is to have the right effort to go outside ourselves, to always have the right mindfulness, which is very important in this moment of crisis, to understand that we are not just suffering endlessly and there's a reason, and have the right concentration, the right purpose to everything. So that's one suggestion, which is the Eightfold Path by Buddha, right? And because, I honestly, this is funny to me, I'm sorry, I never thought I was actually be quoting the Rolling Stones. Looking at the world, I was actually in the plane saying, there's so many beautiful messages out there, and it's great how God lets us see the same thing over and over in different ways in case we don't get it. Maybe the Buddhist approach doesn't resonate with you, right? Maybe the whole figure of the Christ hasn't really resonated with you either, because we've done a tremendous disservice as a humanity through the times in forcing down people's throat an image of Jesus that might not be the most accurate, the most caring and loving. But sometimes something like a song from the Rolling Stones that perhaps are not the best role models out there, and just perhaps, might get to you. And I found myself humming this over and over again from a song, right? You can't always get what you want, but if you try, sometimes you might find you get what you need. Isn't there more financial crisis like? We can't always get what we can't have the physical stuff all that we want. But if we stop and really pay attention to it, we'll find out that we have more than what we need. Maybe I don't need that extra car. I don't need to agonize over the house. Maybe I don't need it because I have my family or I have friends, which I probably haven't been in contact with because I'm so busy working. So maybe I can take some time and reinvest, for lack of a better word, in personal connections. So a rolling stone gathers really no moth, which is really interesting because I just got a personal kick out of that one because I never thought I was going to be actually using the Rolling Stones for anything. And that's what I think is so fantastic about Spiritism, is that it is a progressive body of knowledge, right? It's always moving forward, and it's allowing us to take the blinders and the shutters out of our own ways of thinking, which is really hard because we've been conditioned to think and act a certain way, not just since we were born, but now we know that even before that in other lives. So breaking away those mental patterns that we bring with us, it's really tough. So Spiritism is great because it's a science, which means it's always probing, it's always investigating, it's always looking, it's always learning, which means we should always be probing, we should be always investigating, we should be always looking and trying to find things out. And obviously it's extremely hard to do this because it requires effort all the time and we're not just there yet, but that's okay. But it deals with the nature, the origin, destiny of spirits, as well as their relationship to the corporeal world. It's beautiful because we recognize our spiritual nature. We recognize that there's more than meets the eye, just the physical stuff. And that is our true and primary reason for being, is to evolve morally, right? To be better people. Because only happiness, the only true happiness that we have comes from moral accomplishments. We can see that. I mean, if you don't mind, I'll use Los Angeles as an example. What is the first thing that you come to mind when you think about Los Angeles? Traffic. What else? Hollywood, right? We had the example of Marilyn Monroe today. And it's just a city of lights and illusions. We have this glamour of this great people. They're very special, make a lot of money. And I want to probably, I'm not going to go out on a limb and say I'm going to ascertain, but have you looked at the tabloids lately? Are these people happier than you are? Is wealth an indication of happiness? Clearly not, right? Because physical things will satiate our need for happiness for a short time. After I buy the new car, after the new car smell's gone, the next fix will be another new car. And I'll keep looking for solutions outside of myself. Because for as long as I look outside myself, I don't have to look inside myself. As long as I keep those illusions going on the wall of the allegory of the cave and those flames, I don't have to go out of the cave. I myself am entertained. So we keep trying to fix our void, our emotional void, with material things. And that certainly has not worked. We are healthier, richer, more evolved as a humanity, as a society, than we have ever been in the course of human nature. Yet, never has the suicide rate been higher. Clearly, we've missed a step, or we are in need of something. So we can do something about it. And clear is not the physical way. Well, giving away all our wealth, while nice, maybe not be the solution either. Because we need it. We need a home. We need a car. And just running away from the world and meditating on top of a tree or a hill that nobody is around to talk with me has little merit because I too am not engaging with others. I'm not giving back to the world. So there's got to be a middle point. There's got to be a way for us to balance some use of physical things with the proper application of our intentions and our wisdom and our own teachings. Whatever it is that we want to call it, to live happier lives, right? To dissuade us from feeling that envy that really pains us, and it is true. To practice, because everything is born out of practice. We still have this idea that it just magically happens, or people are naturally smart, or they were born that way, and there's nothing we can do about it. And unfortunately, our society values that too. The effortlessness of things. It's always the get-rich-quick scheme, the get thin quick scheme, something quick right now to fix, to give us that fix that we are waiting for other people to do for us. But we've known through study and through the understanding that through spiritism, because we are in contact with the spiritual world. We see that there is something outside, that there is more to it, that it takes our effort for us to break that barrier of just the material things. And because we can now see what's so-called invisible, we are assured that there is more than meets the eye. Spiritism is great because of that. It reminds us on a daily basis that there are great souls that came before us, and they're giving us a lot of moral guidance and support to let us know that even though happiness is not of this world, there is another world that we are intermingled with, which there is a great more joy and pleasure, where we are not as concerned with passing of time, of gathering of material attachments, because we cannot carry that with us, right? So it's a fantastic and most formidable opponent to materialism, spiritism. Not because it's going to fight materialism and it's going to end it, but it's because it's going to show through facts, through reason, that there is something more. And therefore, we'll be able to make our own choices. And that's what something that's truly fantastic about it all, is that once we realize that, we see crisis differently. And it's no longer crisis. It should be like, crisis, yay! Yeah. Because look, if we look at it from a spiritual perspective, and walk down the road with me, a stage in a sequence of events at which the trend of all future events, for better or for worse, is determined, a turning point. Let me ask you this. If there was not a financial crisis out there today, would this still be true? Wouldn't it today determine the rest of your life? Wouldn't the decisions that you make today determine how your tomorrow is going to be? As we have the feeling of cause and consequence that Spiritism explains to us so well, every moment is extremely important. Because at every moment, we are given a choice. And that choice will likely determine our future. So in a way, we live a crisis every day, every moment. A turning point, possibly. It can be a difficult moment that we find ourselves in. It can be a dramatic emotional circumstance in our lives. But whatever it is, if we don't agonize so much about it because we're so worried about the physical, we will have the presence of mind to stop, to look around, to listen to our intuition, to our spiritual friends and helpers, to understand that we are in control of our own actions. The only thing we can control, and that's barely, is what? Ourselves. Certainly, I can't control other people. I tried. It doesn't work. I think we all tried, right? We all want other people to do what we want. But it doesn't work. And even if they do, sometimes we don't like it. Because we want them to do out of their own heart, not because we want them to do. Anybody that has a spouse, husband, partner, probably figured that part out a long time ago, right? So we have to do that by ourselves, take personal responsibility. So the financial crisis is really a calling for us to say, these are tough times, let's help each other, let's stop the world we do, the way we do things, let's revisit how we are going about our priorities. Are all priorities really our true priorities? Is that what we want? Let's look around and see what are the things I could be doing? What are the things in my life that could be better? What could I change? What should I stay the same? Because it's good, right? We got even that in the question 909 of Spirit's book. St. Augustine gives us a very practical advice, which is every day, evaluate how your day went and think, what are the things that I could improve today? What are the things that I didn't do so great, but that I can improve tomorrow? What are the things that I did well and I want to continue to do that? Because as Aristotle said, we are what we habitually do. So it's a very interesting moment for us to dissuade ourselves from the illusion that there is just one big monster out there and that somebody's got to do something about it. Probably the government. Right? This nation was founded on the ideas of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Of commitment, of putting your sleeves up and getting to work and coming together. This is an extremely generous country. We give more foreign aid than any other country in the world. But let's give to ourselves too. Let's give to our own selves enjoyment, the ability to partake with each other, to be with each other, to really ask ourselves, is it worth to work those 60 extra hours? So if I don't have a time to spend with the people that I'm doing it for. Maybe for a short period of time, yes. But maybe we need to reevaluate. Maybe I don't need that extra, work that hard for the extra new car. Maybe my current car suits me just fine, and I can use that car and spend more time with doing what I really, truly love. So it's a really interesting moment that we find ourselves in. It's really fortuitous, in a way, that we are being constantly called to reflect upon ourselves. The financial crisis is yet another reason, another terrible circumstance in which we have been called to look at what's important to us. To mind, it always comes the example of September 11 as well, which is a horrible tragedy. No doubt has pierced our hearts tremendously, but that also gave us the opportunity to say, you know what, we need to make a better world out of this. The financial crisis teaches, again, to refocus on ourselves and the world and the beautiful things that are out there. And in place of the Edward Munch, the scream that we saw in the beginning when we had the crisis, I figured, what could we put out there that would cheer us up? And I'm not a very flowery kind of guy, but I figure that flowers are a beautiful thing because they're there every day, and oftentimes we just don't see it, right? We go by and we just take it for granted. And yet, it's there every day. And our spiritual mentor, Joanna De Angelis, said that flowers are God's signature on his creation. Just an extra thing that really we didn't need to, but just to let us know that it was him. So it's really interesting for us to see the things that are already there. In our search for pain, for solutions, and for everything else, we oftentimes don't see what's right there beside us. Today we had some great examples of that, if I may, really quickly. We had a beautiful and very opportune message right at the beginning. We talked, Vanessa talked about finding ourselves and the whole dealing with our emotions and understanding envy. We followed up with the idea of examples from the spiritual world of situations in which we find ourselves after and realizing that we could have used our physical opportunities better. And I always have to plug a beautiful book, which is Heaven and Hell. If you want to take a look into the here and after, I always call the Spiritist soap opera. If you're interested into finding out how people's lives go, read Heaven and Hell, the second part. It tells us how they were in life and how they are on the other side. It gives us, you know, very palpable connections. Then after that, we talked about the role of money in our lives. That's a biggie for us. That's super tough. Because it's so easy to be, you know, fascinated by numbers or by the idea of what it really brings us. And then we looked at different ways to address the crisis. But whatever it is that we think about or we do, one must never forget the fundamental and underlying principle, which is we're never alone. God loves us and trusts us so much that, I don't know why, actually I do, out of his own wisdom, he let us make our own choices. There can be no greater proof of love than that we are able to make our own decisions. And whichever decisions we'll make, sometimes the right one, sometimes the not so great one, God's going to be there for us. And we will have another chance. And it's a fantastic opportunity. And we saw the practical application of that right now, earlier today, when we had free hug time. How often do we do this? And maybe we should make that tradition that every time that Daniel changes the tape, you should go and hug him. And by the way, Daniel's currently experienced a hug deficit. So if you haven't had a chance to hug him just yet, help his spiritual economy and give him a hug afterwards, because he's always working back there behind the scenes. But with that in mind, and all jokes aside, I really want to thank you for coming out here today on a Saturday when I know that you could have been doing something possibly a lot more fun. I think not because you came to listen to us, but because you're also doing your effort to try to find a place and a role in the universe. And that's truly fantastic. And if we could all keep doing that, we will then be able to certainly wash away all kind of crises that we have, not only physical, material ones, but those of all, you know, the emotional afflictions that we have out there. Thank you very much for your patience and for indulging me, and I hope you have a great, great night.
So thank you so much, Daniel. And now, because we are going to have our organic fundraising dinner now, and Daniel is going to be among us, we would like to ask you for your questions. Do not hesitate to approach him and ask him questions that pertain to the topics. And you can ask all of your questions to him. Because he volunteered. That's why he got the red eye and spent his time sleeping during the trip so he could be ready for so many questions. And so let us wrap up our moment with, because we know we're not alone here. In these moments, we have many loving and kind spirits that have been here taking care of us. And all that they need now from us to give us more into this stimulus package of spirituality is that we remind ourselves of a teaching that Jesus brought to us, and it's not in the Bible. It's in a book that was psychographed by Chico Xavier of the 412 books. This is one of them. It's named Jesus at Home. And he says, somebody was approaching him to talk about what is this kingdom of heaven that we all look for. And he said, well, it's like the Lord once observed that his people were not doing well. They were sad and alone. So then he called the angels and said, please take the seed of this precious tree and bring it to the people. Give it to them, and it will bring them happiness and harmony. The angels came down to the earth crust, joined the people together, and gave them an orientation, in modern terms, about the precious tree, and said, here is one seed, that's all you need, is one seed, and it's going to give you the tree that is going to bring to all of you happiness and harmony. But the angel said, you are going to have the soil, you the tools, you the water, you, and each one would have something special to contribute in this effort. But the minute each one of them went back home and the angels flew back to where they are, they got home and thought, how can I have the tree for myself? The tree of happiness and harmony for me. How can I be happy? How can I be harmonious? So they start thinking, well, I have the soil in my hands. If I don't share it, people are going to have to give me what they have. So they started battling each other, thinking that one of them could be smarter than the other and get the seed of the precious tree for them alone. And Jesus says, the battle went on and on and on, and the seed wasn't planted. So this is the surprise element in our spiritual stimulus package. It's the seed that tonight we're giving back. And it's the opportunity we have together. It's the secret element of the stimulus package. Teamwork. It's more than a bipartisan effort. It's a multilateral effort, without which we're never going to have this unique seed of happiness and harmony up and running and giving us the fruits of happiness and harmony. With that in mind, let us stay tuned to the good spirits.